Hello everyone, welcome to the Game Engineering Podcast. Today I am honored to speak with Guy Davidson, a legendary figure in the game programming world. He is the man with over two decades of experience at Creative Assembly, so the studio behind the Total War games. He is the ESO C++ committee voting member and the author of the book Beautiful C++. In our conversation, we discuss his programming journey, he shares his thoughts about C++ direction, and he walks me through step by step how C++ standards body operate. And then we discuss his approach to memory management and disk I/O in game development. It was a great honor to host Guy, and he was a pure joy to talk to. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. You are mentioning that you started your programming career in 1980. I was born in 1997. So, yeah, like, you know.
I get a lot of this, obviously. I'm 56 years old. So, wow. Indeed, I was at Creative Assembly for 25 years, and I was interviewing people who were born after I joined, which was you know, quite an interesting state of affairs to find myself in. Now, I started programming in 1980. So back in 1980, the landscape of computing was quite interesting because in the late 70s, all of the stuff that was happening in Silicon Valley was quite a lot of turmoil going on, but the kind of the home computer, the idea of having a computer that's actually quite cheap and personal was becoming quite a new thing. You go back to the early 70s and computers were still massive things that cost a lot of money. And, you know, time on a computer was a precious luxury. The idea of having a computer at what would be the equivalent of about sort of $15,000 in your own home. So, you know, the price of a car, but having a computer instead of a car in your home and tinkering away on it was, you know, an interesting idea. And prices dropped really quite quickly once the first, you know, once the Altair came out. I think it was the Altair was kind of the first sort of mainstream cheap computer, you know, cheap computer for home use. Once that came out, it became, you know, the prices started falling rapidly, and they started turning up in schools in the UK in about 1980. There was a machine called an Acorn Atom, and Acorn are an interesting company. You may have heard of ARM. They started off as Acorn. And Acorn released a machine called the Acorn Atom, and it wound up in schools. It was powered by a 6502 processor. It had a few K of RAM. Processor didn't run very fast, but you know, you could write code. You could use BASIC, which is kind of, I guess, back in the 80s we learned BASIC. Now you'd learn Python. It's the same sort of quality or level. It's the same sort of level of abstraction. And I just wrote code. I was really good at maths. I was one of these kids where they just didn't know what to do with me. Because you know, I just get bored out of my head in maths lessons. I had really good maths teachers, and they really did their best to engage me. But there were 30 students and me, and they said, "Look, here's a computer. Go and use this. Go on, get on the computer, Guy. You should, you know, try this out. See what's going on there." And I thought, "Oh, this is great." I was able to manifest stuff on the screen because it was on a television screen, and it was, you know. I could put colored pixels on the screen. It was all very exciting. And it also tied in with my sort of emerging fascination with video games, with arcades, because...
But the arcades, when is it in the time frame? Because 1980s, arcades were there already.
Yeah, absolutely. But arcades were around long before then. Okay. There have been arcades where people would play games for money, you know, where you drop a coin on a slot and a thing would happen and you'd interact. They've been around for decades, absolutely decades. Indeed, Sega, who bought Creative Assembly in 2005, Sega actually stands for Service Games of America, and they would create electromechanical games for the armed forces as entertainment sort of things on their bases. I believe that's what was going on. But Sega started off, you know, in arcades. But the thing that changed things was the arrival of Pong in the early 70s. And suddenly, this was a properly interactive game entirely on a television screen. It had no moving parts apart from the paddles, the controllers to move the paddles up and down. So it didn't go wrong. In fact, the person who was hosting the machine was simply plug it in, switch it on, and then, you know, collect a bucket of coins at the end of the week, take them to the bank and go, wow, this is brilliant. And it changed the way that arcade entertainment, it changed the whole business model. And the games became more and more interesting and more refined. And obviously the big breakout game was in 1979, a game called Space Invaders. And suddenly everyone was going absolutely bonkers. And I was playing games anytime I could find a 10-penny coin on the floor or scrounge one from my parents or, you know, do a chore around the household. I'd straight away spend this money in an arcade. We'd go on holiday to beaches and there'd be an arcade on the beach and I'd be thinking, I'd be wandering around watching people playing games. I love games. I've always loved games. I had a younger sister and we play games together and I've always loved games. And once I realized there was a very short distance between an arcade game, you know, and the Acorn Atom that I started programming on, and I could see, hey, I can make games on this thing. And I started making games and I was so sort of taken with the Acorn Atom that the following year, my parents said, all right, we'll help you buy your own computer for your own home, which was, it was quite a big undertaking that, you know, it was a big risk on their part because, you know, when you buy toys for your kids, you look through, you go to the shops and say, oh, all the kids love this toy, we'll buy that. Or they love this kit, they love this Lego kit, or they love this sort of construction kit, or these board games. And they buy those. But a computer is one of those sort of, what's going on? He wants a computer. What? Does this mean he's going to need a television, isn't he? Oh, you know, all these sorts of things. But they bought me.
Could they? How did they select? Like, how did they know? What?
I selected.
Okay.
Actually, the computer I bought, the Sinclair ZX81, was advertised in non-computer. I mean, there weren't any computer magazines. They were just regular magazines. You know, there was no World Wide Web back then. There were. So, in fact, if you wanted to watch television, that was fine. You switch television on, you think, oh, what's on television tonight? And you'd go and buy a magazine, and the magazine would list all the programs that were being broadcast during the week. And so every household would buy this magazine. There were two magazines, the Radio Times and the TV Times. And Sinclair advertised in this magazine. They said, look, we've got a computer. And, you know, it's relevant because if you've got a TV, you can run a computer. If you've got a TV, you're going to buy Radio Times or TV Times. And he'd advertise in there and say, oh, home computing at your fingertips. And this was great. And it was £72.90. It was £69.95 plus £2.95 postage and packing. And I saved. I stayed away from the arcades and I saved all my money. And then my parents made up the difference. And then on my birthday, at the end of September in 1981, there was a ZX81 waiting for me and a television and everything I needed to get started. And that was basically it. I was hooked. You know, I never went outdoors again. You know, it was extraordinary. And I started trying to write games. And they were rubbish. Because BASIC is, it's a very high-level language. There's a lot of overhead in getting BASIC working, you know, in the simple interpretation. And also arcade machines were just more expensive. They had color. They had, you know, individually addressable pixels. They had sound chips, all sorts of things like that. But nonetheless, I was still able to write simple primitive games. And in the process of doing so, I learned how to program. I started off in BASIC, beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code, on the Sinclair. And there are many different dialects of BASIC.
You might be one of the few people who know how the abbreviation works.
Possibly, yes. I've heard it described as symbolic instruction code, simple input code, symbolic input code, but it's beginner's all-purpose something something code is the secret. That's the common thread between all the dialects. But BASIC was too it was slow, and it was too. I just couldn't quite get enough out of it, and eventually, after a few weeks, somebody at school had this magazine called Interface. And it had obviously been hand printed on someone had a big sort of A3 photocopier and they'd obviously touched it all. They'd laid it out and they stapled it together. And it was on a subscription. And I said, where'd you get that from? He said, oh, we're from this place. And I subscribed to this thing called Interface. And it was, and it, the world opened up. Interface dealt with the whole home computing boom that was taking place at the time, which I didn't realize. I thought, you know, I discovered there are other machines besides the Acorn Atom and the ZX81. And there were listings of things to type in, listings of games to type in. And there I discovered machine code. I thought, machine code? What the hell is machine code? And started to learn that machine code is actually what basic turns, you know, the computer, yeah. ZX81, had a Z80 CPU in and a ROM, and the ROM, which was the operating system and the programming language, and a floating point calculator. Sorry, a postfix floating point calculator, all in 4K, you know, which is an extraordinary achievement.
4K of RAM, not 4K monitor, like just for the new people.
4,096 bytes. 4,096 bytes from operating system, a calculator, and a programming language. It must be an 8K, actually. I can't remember. Somebody will look up and will correct me, I'm sure. the point, but it might have been 8K. Oh, well, 8K is easy. But you know, there was a tiny amount of space for all of this. So I got into the whole... once I saw what machine code was, and there were books advertised in this magazine, I thought, great, this is fantastic. There's books on how to program machine code. Z80 machine code. Right, okay. And I learned Z80 machine code, and I bought Mastering Machine Code Programming on the ZX81 by Tony. Oh, her name was Tony. Oh, this is really shameful. I don't know her full name. Again, somebody will look up. But the real book was Programming the Z80 by Rodney Zaks. So Rodney Zaks, and he starts a publishing house called Cybex, which published the book. And this was, you know, I gave a talk recently a few years ago, actually, at ACCU. This is the Association of C and C++ Users, which is a professionalism in programming. It's a group in the UK. And we have a conference every year in the spring. There's about 400 or 500 people turn up. I gave a talk and I mentioned Programming the Z80 by Rodney Zaks. And I could just see all these old guys going, oh, yeah. I remember that book. I said, okay, hands up, who's read the book? And it was like people throwing their hands up, going, yeah, it was a fantastic book. So, you know, Rodney Zaks, he needs commemorating. He needs celebrating. There needs to be some kind of, there needs to be a celebration of Rodney Zaks. There really does, because he absolutely cleared it all up for me. Once I had Z80 programming under my belt, I moved on to a new computer called the ZX Spectrum. This had color, this had sound, this had a slightly better keyboard, though not much. And you know, just things went from strength to strength. As the hardware became cheaper and became more available, then I was able to, you know, do more interesting and better things. But there was no industry. There was no games industry. People were still selling cassettes. There were individuals writing games. The games would arrive on a cassette tape. They'd stuff it into a padded envelope, put your address on the envelope, send it to you. And I get this padded envelope in the post, stamp on with a handwritten address, and pull it out, and there was a cassette, and I put the cassette in, and it would work, and everything would be fantastic. And by about 1984, 1985, it started to become a bit more industrial, is the wrong word, but there was a commercial, you know, it became commercial. You could go and buy games, you could actually buy games in shot. These are the exciting, heady times. This is how I got started in games. And then I went to university, and I did a maths degree, and I was still writing games. I got, you know, upgraded computers to the Atari ST. I was moving on to 68,000 assembly programming. And it was just more on. I was always working at the assembly level. It wasn't until, the late 80s, 89, 90, or something like that, where I moved on to C. And I thought, oh, this is interesting, because C is like, I looked at C and I thought, well, I can actually see the assembly language here. I can see what's going on. I thought, oh, this is great, but I can do better. I could always write better assembly language than the C compiler could generate. And so it took me a while to, you know, kind of like move into C. I think C compilers started to outpace me in about 1991 or 92. They started to get really good. And I thought, oh, actually, do you know what?
It's much better. In what way outpaced you?
Because, a C compiler will take your code and will turn it into machine code of the target machine. Now, Quite often, it would be the case that you would know more about the problem being solved than the compiler in that instance. And so you could produce code that would run faster, running fewer instructions, use fewer registers, use less memory, all that sort of thing. And I would say, all right, I'm not going to use this C. I'm going to actually write my own. I'm going to write the function. I'm going to hand code this function Z80 assembly myself. Of course, that's not portable. That is not at all portable that way. And the thing that C gives you, great portability. You want to use C for portable programming rather than hand coding assembly for each platform you're expecting to deliver on. And even today, the Microsoft Visual C compiler has tons of switches for which sort of SIMD instruction set you're using and all that sort of thing. So, portability is increasingly important there. But I started writing in C and set assembly aside. And I, at this point, I actually got a job writing sort of interactive presentations and things like that. And I was using this language called Toolbook, which was kind of like, I think they were called 4GLs back then. It was like a programming language.
Toolbook.
Okay. Toolbook by Asymmetrics. I think it's still on the go. It's still running. It's pretty good. I used it for ages and ages. But I had to move into that. We had to write an extension for the operating system for Windows, and we had to do that in C. And I said, I'm going to take a look at this C++ business. What's going on here? And so we got the Microsoft first Microsoft the Microsoft C++ compiler that was released in 1992. It had a meter of documentation, a meter of a bookshelf. A meter of your bookshelf would be taken up with all the documentation. It was version 1.0 of the Microsoft Foundation classes. And I just read all the documentation. The employer said, all right, guy, you're in charge, what are you gonna do? And I said, I guess I'll start with the documentation. Because there was no web then, there was no World Wide Web. Again, everything was printed. So if you wanted documentation about how the Windows API worked, you bought the book.
Bought the book.
And that's what came. There was loads of documentation. I went through it all. So there was documentation about Microsoft Foundation classes, documentation about the Windows SDK, and this was 16-bit Windows at the time. And then there was and documentation about the C++ programming language. I didn't know which order to read it in. The smart thing to do would have been read about the programming language, then read about the OS. Then read about MFC, and there are other things about writing device drivers as well. But that's where I kind of properly transitioned, and I realised I'd actually been using C and C++ in the 80s. But I hadn't really kind of twigged that this is what I've been doing. So I'd had bits and pieces of work in my gap year between school and university. And I've been writing in that. But it wasn't until then that things started to fall into place. And this is one of the things, isn't it? When you're learning stuff, you don't know what it is that you're learning until you finish learning it. And you look back and there's that kind of light bulb moment where things all start to fit together. But that period of learning C++, and I was thinking, this is great because I've got this mechanism of describing, I can solve problems by factoring them into classes and functions and abstractions. And
this was when?
C++. 1992. So this was before C++ was standardized. At the time, so C++, the standardization effort, I think, started in 1989. And the idea was to get it out in like 2 or 3 years. The first standard wasn't published until 98. to be perfectly frank, we didn't finish standardizing until 20. It wasn't until we got concepts in and requires clauses that we could really say, okay, drop that. We've wanted concepts forever because it's those things that constrain overloads or it's requires clauses that constrain overloads. And that's, this is how you want to be using overloads. Yeah. Overloads are function templates. You don't just want to be naming functions and giving them the same name all the time. Overloads are the function templates, constructors and operators. That's it. But yes, the process of standardization was unfinished, which meant that, if I recall correctly, the version of C++ I was using in 92 by Microsoft didn't support templates. It supported virtual functions, but it didn't support templates and exceptions. I think there was something like that. So other documentation that I was reading, other books I was reading, like the Scott Myers books, Beautiful C++, that's my Effective C++. Scott wrote Effective C++. I wrote Beautiful C++. Okay. let's set that straight. Scott Myers' books would talk of these things that I had no access to because I was using the Microsoft C++ compiler. I was thinking, this is, what's going on here? And also, you know, I was just a jobbing C++ programmer. The first standard arrived in 1998. I actually entered the games industry in 1997. I spent 5 years. Do you know, I'm doing all the talking here.
That's good. That's good. This is what I was trying to get to. Where at this point you're becoming full game developer in a sense, where you're programming games, because you started, you loved games, but then the work, your first work wasn't in the games industry. So when did it switch?
Well, I got paid to write games in 1997 when I joined Codemasters, but I was always writing games beforehand and trying to, you know, hawk them around. As I said, there was the industrial process wasn't really in place. The commercial sort of the business model wasn't really in place in the 90s. It kind of was in place in the 90s, but it was still, you know, there was no easy way of getting recruited into a games company. But in 1997, I was looking for, I was just looking for any work at all in 1997. I was looking for freelance work. And I went for an interview with the Digital Village. Now, the Digital Village was the brainchild of Douglas Adams, author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And he'd opened a place in Islington, which was a bit of a journey for me, and he was looking for programmers. I thought, all right, this is great.
What was the job about?
Just a programmer to help push the title Starship Titanic over the line.
Okay.
And I didn't get it. I didn't get the job. I made a fool of myself, to be perfectly honest. I regretted it enormously. But I did end up getting a job with Codemasters. And I thought, okay, this is great. I'm in games, brilliant. I haven't quite reached 30 and I've got into the games industry. This is great. I went to Codemasters. It was about an hour and a half's commute to get there from where I was living. And we wrote a game called Prince Nazim Boxing. I say we wrote a game. We started writing a game called Prince Nazim Boxing, but it took a very long time to write. And eventually, the London office was just too expensive to run the London office because Codemasters actually was headquartered in Leamington Spa, about 200 miles north in, or 100, yeah, about 200 miles north in Warwickshire. So I actually got laid off before the game was finished. And I was there for something like 21 months, and they'd already started making the game when I joined. And 21 months later, they still hadn't finished it. And they put loads of people in there. I honestly don't know how many copies were sold.
But that's not long for today's standards, right?
By today's standards, it's not long at all. But back then, you'd expect to write a game in 3 months. You'd be expected to do 4 games a year. You know, a team would do a game in 3 months, and then, you know, shovel the next one out, unless it was something really exceptional and special. And, you know, attaching a license to a game. Attaching, you know, licensing Prince Nazim, licensing a sports person was, you know, one way of garnering sales. It still is. You know, you can still say, you know, I don't know if there was a Tiger Woods golf game. I'm sure there was a Tiger Woods golf game. I'm just saying the words Tiger Woods golf game. I think Penny Arcade, which is one of my favorite blogs, by the way. Penny Arcade, I think the writers there are quite fond of golf. It was a game that was... I mean, boxing is a tricky game to write anyway. You know, it demands such fluidity and athleticism from the participants, from the competitors. And that's very difficult to do. You know, PlayStation 1, 32 megabytes of RAM, I think. I forget.
But,
you
know, how much?
32 megabytes of RAM on PlayStation 1.
Okay.
32 meg. It could have been 60. But whatever, it was absolutely not enough. You know? To handle all the animations and all the varieties of boxes that you wanted, so it was a massive undertaking. Eventually I was laid off, and I joined Creative Assembly shortly afterwards. But you know, so I started writing games. I started being paid to write games. 27 years ago. But I've been writing games for over 40 years.
Yeah, and when you're saying how much of the effort it was to make this game, by the way, the boxing game, Like, what components did you have to build just to make
it? What components did I have to build? At the time, I walked in on day one and I was, and they said, "Yeah, can you do the AI, please?" I was like, "What?" do the AI, and I had no idea what they were talking about. I know my girlfriend at the time studied philosophy in cognitive science at university around the same time I was studying mathematics and computer science. So I studied a lot of AI kind of with her on the side. Except it wasn't really AI, it was more sort of philosophy.
Yeah.
So it's things like epistemology and you know, the whole sort of gamut of philosophy, basically, or you know, how does human thought work anyway? All these kinds of things. So when this chap says to me, can you work on the AI? And I was thinking, it was a very strange sentence to hear. But effectively I was doing the working out how the boxers would actually interact, how they'd face each other, what attacks they'd use, what punches they'd use, how they'd dodge, how they'd, you know, all this kind of thing, without any consideration whatsoever. So, as I say, this 32 megabytes of RAM that was available on the machine itself, it didn't go very well, to be honest. I've always been a low-level programmer. I've always written code very close to the metal.
Then you switched to Creative Assembly.
I got laid off. I went to Creative Assembly. Ostensibly, I was brought on to assist with migrating everyone over to C++. Creative Assembly then was formed in 1987, and it was really doing sports conversions and things like that. And you know, I thought, am I to be dogged by sports titles? The thing is, you know, I don't really like sports titles. I was actually interested in working for people who did Tomb Raider at the time, and there was an opportunity available to get a programming job on Tomb Raider.
But it's not Creative Assembly, right?
No, Creative Assembly didn't make Tomb Raider. I think Tomb Raider was made by, I think they were called Core, and they were published by IDOS at the time. And but I thought, I love this game. If I work on this game, I'll hate this game. You know, it kind of takes it away from you. So, you know, this is one of the things, sports titles. Yeah, I don't care about sports titles. I'm just in the games industry, making games, doing interesting things with computers, doing interesting things, you know, at a very low level with computers. So, you know, doing sports titles at Creative Assembly was fine. The commute was a load better, I tell you what. Whilst I was at Codemasters, we moved from Mortlake to Hammersmith, which added an extra 20 minutes to my journey. And it was an hour and three quarters each way to get to work. And, you know, I did a lot of reading and so on, but it was expensive. And, you know, that was nearly 4 hours out of my day just traveling. So it wasn't much of a life. It really wasn't. Whereas Creative Assembly, that was sort of 35 minutes door to door. In the car, it was much better. It was a much better, you know, life choice for me.
In Creative Assembly, with the old Total War franchise, when did it start?
Right. Well, the first Total War title was Shogun, which I think was released in 2000. Yeah. But I joined in 1999 when we were still doing sports titles, and the Total War title was going on in the background. The sports titles were keeping the money coming in, and that was being used to fund Total War. So I didn't do much work on Shogun Total War at all. I kind of helped out a bit. I did some debugging. I did bits and pieces, but I didn't. I wasn't a full member. I think I'm credited with additional programming, although I don't even know if we did that then.
Okay. I'd like to switch to more technical things. Sure. So. Can you tell me a little bit more about, like, how do you see C++ in terms of the abstraction for games programming? Because you were coding in assembly, handcrafting assembly, then doing the C, then C++, and somewhere along the way, like, the game programming stops, let's say, at C++. It doesn't go that much up. Like, not many people try to do proper game in a Python, for example, since. Things like that. So where do you see this, like, abstraction Like, where do you see game development fit into this, like, abstraction?
Okay, great question. We probably need a bit of history here, which is that during the 80s, games were sold based on frame rate. You know,
what do you mean?
Frame rate. How many frames a second would the game play at? Now, back in the 80s, computers, home computers, were attached to domestic television sets. And there were two frequencies. There was 50 hertz in the UK, and I think also in Europe, and 60 hertz in America. Now, this meant that you had a hard boundary for how much time you had to calculate your next frame and say, right, we're going to display this frame now. And this had some really interesting side effects. One being that you prepare a frame, submit the frame for rendering, and it was memory match. You'd be writing the frame to memory as it was being displayed. And you'd get a little tear, sort of like some three quarters of the way down the screen, where it was still displaying the old screen, the old frame, because you hadn't got round to updating the entire frame in time. Because, you know, the way that old televisions worked, right, okay, cathode ray tube. A cathode ray tube is an electron gun that scans lines, you know, one at a time, from top to bottom. Actually, it does two passes, and it does alternate scans in each, alternate lines in each pass. Anyway, but the point being that every time it hits a every time the beam scans along the cathode ray tube, it illuminates a phosphorescent compound with a particular color, and that's how you get your colors on the screen. So, as you can imagine, the hardware is saying, okay, you know, red pixel, blue pixel, red pixel, blue pixel, green pixel, blue, you know, but really, really fast, much faster than that. And there is this period where the electron beam returns. This is called the vertical sink. So the electron beam scans all the way to the bottom of the tube, and then it goes all the way back up, and then it quickly, so it goes diagonally back up to the top, and then starts the whole process again. And so what you had to do, really, was swap. You could either double buffer. You say, right, we're preparing one frame and displaying another one, or you could, but obviously that takes more memory because you've got two buffers there, or you simply update on the fly. And there are all sorts of weird anyway, the point being there were all sorts of weird artifacts that were that would emerge from gameplay. Now, the best games would run at 25 hertz. You know, nothing could run at 50 hertz. You know, that would be nonsense. You didn't, you know, 50 hertz means 20 milliseconds to do everything. And when your processor is running at less than 1 megahertz, you know, 20 milliseconds is a lot. It's a lot of time. But 25, you know, if you had your game running at 25 megahertz, that meant that you get a smooth display, you get a smooth gaming experience. So you'd start at 25 hertz, and think, right, what can I cram onto the screen in this amount of time? What can I display, and what gameplay can I sort of express in this period of time? And that's how things worked. The more you could, the more interesting you can make your game, the more, the richer you could make your display in that amount of time, the better things were. And that's why you wrote in assembly rather than BASIC, because in assembly you could get so much more done. You had so much finer controlled access to the frame buffer. Everything, you know, everything worked. Now, and that's been the way all the way through. Frame rate. Okay. So frame rate is what frame rate is how things are sold. The amount of eye candy you can get on screen in the, you know, in the amount of time it takes to display a frame. And now obviously I've seen, you know, 144 hertz monitors and things like that. You know, the kind of frame rate that's almost beyond notice, you know, I'm not sure that our persistence of vision is that refined that we can spot 144 hertz. I haven't really done much work with that sort of scale. But the reason why we went from assembly to C to C++ was because we could see that the code that was being generated was appropriate. It would work. You know, we could go, you know, you could write C and you could see it generating the assembly and thinking, oh, that's great. I don't need to write in assembly. I can write in C and everything's going to be fine. And then when I started at Codemasters in 1997, there was, not C++. No, C++ is too slow. I thought, that's a very strange thing to be hearing. But I thought, all right, whatever you say, C++ is too slow. So, because, you know, it was my first time writing games, not in assembly, you know. I didn't, it kind of didn't make sense to me, that sort of statement. But when I got to Creative Assembly, we were moving into C++ and we were using Microsoft compilers and things like that, then it did make sense, because one of the things that C++ does that C doesn't is it has better abstraction facilities. Now, you have things like classes. You do have things like function overloading and things like that. You've got templates. You've got generic programming. And that makes it much easier to write stuff that's reusable for other people to use. Because one of the problems of writing something in assembly is it's very hard to understand. You know, it's very hard for someone else. You know, if you've got a team of programmers, you've got to explain to them, all right, this function does that. And I go, all right, is that the function I need? And, you know, if you've got like a 200 instruction function to digest, you're just not going to manage. You know, the thing that abstraction does is it hides complexity. You know, a function is basically an abstraction of a body of execution. You know, and C gave you a way of naming functions, because beforehand in assembly, you had no way of naming functions. You just stick a label somewhere in your source code and saying, right, this function starts here at this label called squirt or something, you know, for square root or something like that. Whereas with C, you could actually name your functions and you could say, all right, these functions in this translation unit, they're all arithmetic functions. They're square root and power and sine and cosine, you know, because obviously you'd use Taylor series for trigonometric expansions because it was quicker than, you know, you could work to the precision that you wanted. And C++ gave you more mechanisms for abstraction. You know, besides the function, it gave you the class. It gave you a way of bundling together a concept and saying, okay, well, look, here's a thing. Here's a cash desk or a warrior or a sword. And here are things you can do to the sword. And here's things you can find out about from the sword. And you know, you can wave the sword, or you can see how much damage it does, all that sort of thing.
And this ability for C++ to still compile the code, for example, and then run it through disassembly and see the assembly code that you have generated from C++, is it still important for you with your work?
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's, you know, for a number of reasons. I mean, bear in mind, you know, the first C++ compiler was actually produced C, not assembly. The first C++ compiler was, it was called CFront. Björn Stroustrup wrote it. And you write your C++, you run it through CFront, and it would produce C. And then you compile the C, and then that would produce the assembly, and then you'd run the assembly. And it was great because CFront could use the existing ecosystem, all the tool sets, all the nice stuff, editors and debuggers that were already available through C. And actually, there's another project on at the moment called CPP2.
That's also on my list of questions. But let's do it. Let's do it.
Do you want to do it now?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so we've got CPP2. So yeah, CPP2, it does much the same thing. It transpiles your CPP2 code into C++, and then you build C++, and again, you've got all the same. You've got the ecosystem available to you. You know, writing a language is actually, it's not easy, but it's writing the language itself is a tiny part of the problem. You know, if you haven't got a good ecosystem for packaging, for delivery, distribution, chaining, debugging, linking, hosting, unless you've got all of that stuff, you know, you've still got a lot of work to do. And lots of people who are really good at writing languages are rubbish at writing ecosystems. You know, it's a very specific skill.
Let's linger on this one. So CPP front, or sometimes called CPP2, right? It's an ongoing project to create a new C++ syntax that would be transpiled to C++, and we are working C++, but with all the new, let's say, fixed defaults or things like that, so that you could have like an easier and more safe C++ with the newer version, newer syntax. What do you think? What do you think about that, General?
Yeah, I think it's great. You know, it's so Herb Sutton did a talk last year at CPPCon, and he said, you know, CPP2 is to C++ what TypeScript is to JavaScript. You know, you can write stuff in TypeScript and it just works in the JavaScript ecosystem. It provides stuff for JavaScript. You know, it says, look, hey, we've got this thing, JavaScript. Would you like to use this facility that we've devised for TypeScript? And JavaScript says, you know what, that's great. Yeah, we'll have that. Suck it up, you know, add it in. And it's fabulous. And the same goes for CPP2 and C++, the three-way comparison. You know, the spaceship operator. That started off in CPP2. And proposed it for C++, and the C++ committee went, wow, yeah, that's great. Yeah, let's have that. That's the kind of the model it works on. I think this is a more likely model for success than things like Carbon and Rust and all the others, because they're building on a new ecosystem, as it were. Actually, I think Carbon does involve the existing ecosystem.
I think Carbon is trying to do exactly the compatible code with C, right? Or C++, I don't remember now. But it was supposed to be still compatible with all your project that is written in C. So you can have like a new files with the ecosystem, but you don't really disrupt your old tools now. Yeah. And Rust is something different. Rust has a whole new ecosystem, package management, tools, and things like that.
Yeah. I'm a C++ programmer. I don't have enormous amounts of time to spend time in Carbon and Rust, so I'm the wrong person to ask about how this kind of things work. But I have subscribed to the CPP2 GitHub. I recommend people do that, because that's just the best way of finding out about something, is look at the changes that are being made and the discussions that are being had. And if you submit to the CPP2 GitHub pull requests, then you can see how the language is developing and what it's all about.
It's still in early stages, though. It's nowhere, let's say, near done. And like, even in the description, it's still like blatantly states that it's in development. It's in progress, just for like people to hone in, give some feedback and things like that.
Yeah, it's a decade away from production. So decade away, but it's. I'd love to use it now. There are all sorts of lovely things about it, but it's a hard sell to an employer who's giving you money to build a product that they're going to sell and support, to say, hey, do you know what? Let's not use C++. Let's bang in some CPP2. I mean, you can, build by the side some, support. Like the build system I'm working in at the moment, I could credibly shoehorn in CPP2 as an optional build. Build step, saying, okay, we build all the C++, now we'll build all the CPP2, now we'll link it all together. I could do that, but I'm not ready to do a thing like that yet.
I think you also come from this school, let's say, where you're sticking with the product, like with the language, right? With the C++, mm-hmm. you stick with it for the long time. And like, I think a lot of people, let's say, especially in the startup scene, like the language is not that, I think, important to them currently. Like, they just pick some things, and like, software engineers are not encouraged to learn deeply what the language does, but to know them very little, but all of them pretty much, but very little. Also, on this note, how do you see this? If, would you recommend now people diving into C++ and trying to learn C++ only, but very detailed and specific, and like all the nooks and crannies in language? Because like, the, I would say, market encourages to learn pretty much everything but a little bit. And C++ is a very different beast. And you kind of want to take all the 20 plus years of development and like set aside and learn it slowly.
Yeah. It's C++ is a formidable language to learn. The standard now, it runs to well over 2,000 pages. It's a big old language. We're making it simpler, with each new standard that comes out. Although we're adding stuff to it, we're also taking stuff away, or we're simplifying how things are done. But having said all that, it's a big language, and it has to be a big language, because the whole point is that it's a zero cost abstraction. There is zero overhead to the abstraction. And that takes some doing. That really does take, that's not a trivial thing to achieve. I think that you should learn the languages that solve the problems that you are being presented with. I think learning just to something, right, I'm going to go and learn C++. No, don't go and learn C++. Learn programming, learn problem solving. And then along the way, look at the languages that solve, C++ doesn't have native networking still, after all these years. After you can't like open up your IDE and say, right, I'd like to open an encrypted socket to google.com or bbc.co.uk and get, you can't do that. You've got to find a library, choose a library, learn how to use, that's, it's very disappointing that that's the state of affairs. So if you're doing networking, you might decide, well, okay, how critical is, you know, C++ performance to this? You know, maybe I could just get away with, you know, Python and a Python library, or Go or something like that. Neither of which are languages I know very well, so they could be completely ridiculous examples. But the point is that there are, you know, there are other places, you know, there are other ways to solve the problem than C++. I just happen to be in the situation writing games where it's C++ top to bottom. It's C++ top to bottom, because that's where all the programmers learn C++. So games dev people hire C++ programmers, and it just reinforces. I know that there are people who've tried to write game engines in Rust. There's a former Creative Assembly colleague of mine called Tosh Stakoviak, I think his name was, and he wrote a renderer in Rust and published it, and it made waves. It was quite something. I think it was in 2022. But I don't see adverts for games written for game development engineers who are competent in Rust. I only see C++.
You don't see it changing, or?
I don't see it changing because I remember when Doom was written back in 1993, and Doom was written in C, with the exception of, I think it was a straight line drawing algorithm. I think that was written in assembly, but Doom was written in C, and it offered no performance penalty for so doing, apart from the straight line bit, which Carmack wrote in, wrote in assembly. And the migration to C++ took place when it was simply available on the side, because you were writing using the using Microsoft's development suite, and that offered C and C++. And people were doing things in C++ and thinking, oh, this is handy. Oh, I could actually, you know, people were using classes and realizing that they could trivially add extra bits in C++. And eventually, between the late 90s and early noughties, kind of we just drifted over to C++ and stopped really thinking about C, because C++ was backwards compatible with C. I don't see it changing, because there needs to be a really strong motivation to change ecosystems, to move to a different compiler, a different, if you take you have a studio of a dozen C++ programmers, and you say, okay, everyone, I want you to learn Rust. And everyone goes, can we afford to retool? Because that's what you're talking about, isn't it? You're saying, okay, I want you to put away all your tools and build a new set. You know, if you're making a factory, you're running a factory and you're making cars, you say, all right, we're not going to make cars anymore, we're going to make hair dryers. And then everybody in the factory goes, have you lost your mind? What do you mean by making hair dryers? We've got to get rid of all of these tools that we have for making the cars and put in tools to make hair dryers instead. That's nuts. Why not just open a hairdryer factory across the road and we'll carry on making cars? That's what you're looking at when you say, hey, everyone, let's stop making games in C++. Let's make them in Rust. Now, I know that there are Rust aficionados out there, crustaceans. And I believe, you know, and I'm sure plenty of them are doing things like writing games and writing code and stuff like that. And in the fullness of time, I'm sure we will see commercial games being released in Rust. But, you know, migrating everybody wholesale, I'll have retired by the time anything like that happens. You know, that's years and years away.
Let's linger a little bit on the C++ standard. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit more about committee, how this works?
How does the committee work? Right. Yes. I can talk for hours about how the committee works. I first started working on the committee, and I didn't realize this. I started first, it was about 2015. Now, what happened for me? So I'll tell you about my way in and how it happened. So in CPPCon in 2014, there was a grill the committee session, and somebody asked, so, you know, where's the game dev people? And there was like an uncomfortable silence, because game dev is one of the top three users of C++. And there was a kind of a mailing list was formed, and game developers joined the mailing list. And actually, Scott Myers asked me, he suggested that I look it up and look into it and find out. And he sent me a link, and I joined it. Because I just had Scott Myers in doing training for our C++ engineers at Creative Assembly. And he said, hey, join this guy. I'm like, oh, okay, all right, let's take a look at this. And I suddenly got sort of woven into the mailing list, into the whole thing. So I was on that mailing list for a little while, and then I was told about the BSI. So the BSI is the British Standards Institute. Every country has a standards body. And the British one is called the BSI. The German one is, the French one is AFNOR. The German one, I think it's called DIN, D-I-N. And all of these national bodies are federated under an international, well, actually, the national bodies are federated under several international organizations. So one international organization is ISO, headquartered in Geneva. And ISO has a... So ISO has this like deep hierarchical structure. So ISO has a joint technology committee, and that joint technology committee, JTC1, has a subcommittee, subcommittee number 22. Subcommittee number 22 is system software, programming languages, system software and its environments and APIs. And subcommittee 22 has a number of working groups. For example, working group number 14 is the C programming language, and working group number 21, WG21, is the C++ programming language. So ISO, and this is a joint operation with the International Electrotechnical Commission, IEC. So ISO / IEC, JTC1 / SC22 / WG21 is the C++ Standards Committee. And I joined that committee by joining the British Standards Institute C++ panel. That's BSI / IST / 5 / - 21. I have no idea where there's a hyphen in there, but there is.
You know, I wouldn't expect anything else from standards body. Indeed.
So after I've been spent a couple of years, you know, mooching around on the, you know, lurking and contributing to this this mailing list, it was formally the mailing list was formally turned into a study group inside WG21, study group 14, and study group 14 was about banking low latency high performance programming. Sorry, no, hang on. Low latency, high performance. Yeah, it was. I think it's short. The short name is low latency programming, but it's for banking, finance, gaming, all that kind of the fast moving stuff. And once I was in SG14, they said, yeah, you probably need to go to the BSI. And the what now? So I found the BSI, joined the BSI, and once I joined the BSI as a C++ expert. I'm an expert. Hit me. Look at this. You know, I joined the panel as a C++ expert, and that got me into the ISO Global Directory of C++ Experts. And once I was on the Global Directory of C++ Experts, I was able to participate in C++ standards meetings. And I went to my first C++ committee meeting in 2017 in Toronto, and that was quite something, because you know, I'm used to being, you know, if not the smartest person in the room, you know, really thinking, I'm on top of all of this. This is good. But I went to the committee and I felt like an absolute buffoon. I felt like an idiot. I thought, what am I doing here? I had spectacular imposter syndrome. I was thinking, this is nonsense. I have no place here at all, really. You know, and I was there to defend a paper which was to introduce, you know, a 2D drawing library to the C++ standard, it didn't go well. And it continued to not go well for a couple of years because I just didn't know what was going on. I didn't know how it all worked. You know, I was joining somebody else who'd been working on the paper for a few years. And I thought, yeah, I can help with here. I've got game knowledge.
How does this work a little bit more detail? Like, you have a paper, okay, and then you're trying to defend it on a committee meeting? Like,
right. Okay. So the way that you expand the language, the grow the language or grow the library, or the way that you grow the standard is that you have a system of proposals. So I look at something, I say, do you know what? What we need is, so for example, static assert. Static assert is great. Oh, look, you're doing this. You've got this, you're building this function template. Halfway through, you think, do you know what? The input type is wider than the output type. That's not allowed. And so you'll statically assert that, send up a message, and compilation will halt. What if instead you wanted to simply notify the user, but not halt compilation? So let's say we want a new feature that's not static assert, it's static remark or static warn or something like that. You think, okay, we want a new feature called static warn. What should we do now? So you have to write a proposal, and you send that proposal to the evolution working group. So that proposal would say, would describe, okay, here's the thing I want to do. Here's the problem I want to solve. Here's the effect it has on the rest of the language. Here's some implementation experience. I tried doing this in Clang and GCC, for example. You know, here's what other people think about it. Here's a branch of Clang that you can link, that you can try it out on Compiler Explorer. Come on, everybody, what do you think? Now, that proposal will be submitted to the secretary of the committee. That's Nina Rands. Nevin Lieber. I don't know what his name is. I don't know what his title is. Nevin Lieber. Anyway, Nevin Lieber, he manages all the papers. And so he'll receive the papers and go, right, okay. And every month he will assemble all the papers into a single mailing. And people will get this big, will be notified and say the mailing is ready. And then there's a website, you go to the website, and there's a list of all the papers for this month. The last mailing, which was about a week or so ago, had over 100 proposals in it. It's a big deal. So we get all these proposals. Now, three times a year, the committee will meet. So we're next meeting in Tokyo in the middle of March. I'm very much looking forward to that. Now, at a typical committee meeting, we'll have a mailing. We'll read all the things that interest us. We can't possibly read all of the papers, but we read all the things that interest us. And then the committee meets in a number of groups. So there are two types of group. There's the... I'll just describe the groups, actually. So we have study groups, study group 14, which is where I came in. But we also have a group on contracts, which is study group 21. And we have a group on ranges, study group 9, on reflection and metaprogramming, study group number 7. Each of these groups has a chair, and they will meet for a morning or afternoon or a few afternoons or a few or a couple of days during this 1 week. It's a 5-day session. They'll meet a couple of times, and they'll look at papers and say, right, this paper passes muster here in the specialist group, so we'll just advance it forward for consideration by the wider community. And that wider community is the Evolution Working Group and the Library Evolution Working Group. So the Evolution Working Group looks at changes to the language, and the Library Evolution Working Group, as I'm sure you can guess, looks at changes to the standard library. So I spend most of my time in the Library Evolution Working Group, but also in SG6, which is numerics, maths, and things like that. I have a maths degree. I'm interested in maths. I'm trying to get linear algebra into the standard. We have a form of linear algebra already in there through the extraordinary work of Mark Herman and his collaborators with the... we've now got a lovely C++ interface for the BLAS. But I want to add linear algebra with operations. So you can say, matrix 1 times matrix 2 equals matrix 3, that kind of stuff, just like you get in the textbooks. So Library Evolution Working Group will look at all the papers that target the library and say, no, mate, that API, that's rubbish. or don't like those names, or no, that name's already in use over there. You haven't noticed it, have you? And they'll look at the particular aspects of library design and say, no, we need to make some changes here. This doesn't look great. Tell me about your user experience. Because if you're proposing to standardize a library, the assumption is that this library exists in the wild and it's got 1,000 users who all think it's brilliant. So you're standardizing existing practice. So that's and the same process works for Evolution Working Group. I don't spend much time in there at all, but papers that target the language rather than library, they go to Evolution Working Group. They look at they do the same sort of thing. They look at it and say yes or no. Please go away, consider this, come back and represent. Once it's got past the design groups, Evolution Working Groups, it goes to the wording groups. Now the C++ standard is this massive legal document. It must be unambiguous. There must be no ambiguity. So you make a proposal, but you've also got to write the wording for it. You've got to say, right, how am I going to express this library or this feature in the standard? And that's quite an undertaking. And the wording groups are really, they are talented, gifted people who look at what you're saying. And most of the working group people, the wording groups people, they're implementers. They're people who write the standard library implementations for your favorite compiler, who write your compilers. And they will knock the wording into shape and say, this is what you mean, isn't it? And you're looking, that is exactly what I meant. That's very clever. Wow, thank you very much. They'll knock it into shape. Now, once the wording group So once the design groups have seen something and the wording groups have got the wording correct, it's advanced to the straw polls. So what happens at the end of each committee on the Saturday morning is that we will vote all the proposals that have made it all the way from study group to design group to wording group and out the other side. We'll vote on which papers we're going to modify the standard with.
And in the numbers, how many papers do you start with in the design groups and how many get to the voting, the straw polls? Roughly.
That's not a useful metric.
Yeah.
So roughly, we'll probably vote in sort of 20 to 40 papers at closing plenary.
Okay.
But as I say, there are 100 papers in the 100 proposals in the mailing, but proposals go through many, many, many revisions. So Stud Hive was added, I think it's going to be added this time around. And that's been through over 20 revisions. So, you know, although there might be 100 papers, many of those will be making their third, fourth, fifth visit to the mailing list. So it's not like we're getting 100 new papers every month. You know, there's a lot of revisions going on. There might be sort of like 9 or 10 or 11 papers that are actually new in each mailing every month.
Okay, straw polls. I interrupted you.
Straw polls. We vote on the straw polls. Now, the straw polls should just go through because the idea is that by the time a paper has reached the straw poll stage and, you know, it will have been... people will have had months and months and months to look at the thing. It's extraordinarily rare for a paper to be, you know, written on Monday and then voted in on Saturday. I think it might have happened once or twice as a kind of an emergency correction or something like that. I know that when Contracts was taken out of the C++20 standard, I know that all happened very quickly. But once something has got to the straw poll stage, the assumption is that everyone's happy with it. And so we vote on those proposals that have reached the straw polls page. We vote on the proposals, and then once they're accepted, then we have an editing group. And the editing group will add all of those proposals into the standard. Right now, Thomas Kuffer is the editor of the C++ standard. Before him, it was Richard Smith of Google. And theirs is the hardest job because they've got to take those words and slot them into the standard. And the trouble is, of course, some of those papers might overlap. You know, some of those proposals might say, right, in this clause here, we're going to add this text. And another paper comes along and says, in this clause here, we're going to add this text. And they have to reconcile this. And so they'll send this, and they might reconcile it by sending it back to the committee and saying, all right, we need to have another vote on how we're going to reconcile this. Or they'll do it themselves. They'll make editorial changes. And there are rules about drafting a standard. Words that you're allowed to use, you know, are you allowed to say must, might, shall, would, all that sort of thing? You know, what does it all mean? But every 3 years, we'll, you know, the editing team will say, right, we're done. That's C++26 or that's C++23. They'll send it to Geneva. Geneva will say, all right, we'll just publish this. And we call it C++23, but it was, I think it's just been published in 24. And so Geneva, so ISO, we'll name it. We'll give it the name :2024, but it is C++23 because that's how we socialize and market it. 2023 is when we, the committee, stop working on it and move on to 26.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and then, so the committee meetings are 3 times a year.
Yep.
And you add those things to the standard, and every 3 years, the current version is published as a...
That's right.
Okay.
So we have a working draft. So the first thing that happens... The first thing that happened in 2023, the first 2023 meeting, was to create a working draft. So the working draft is a copy of the existing standard. You say, right, here's the working draft. And then every proposal will amend the working draft with its content, with its proposed wording updates. And every 3 years, we'll seal the working draft and say, right, feature freeze. So actually, we do a feature freeze 1 year before and say, right, we're only interested in papers now which fix stuff that's already been proposed, rather than we're not adding new features now that can go into the next standard. And this is one reason why C++ has worked so well. The first standard was released in 98, and there was a technical corrigendum in 2003. And then the next standard was released in 2011. 13 years, which, you know, that's an insane amount of time. The 2000s were barren. Java, you know, really took off in the 2000s because C++ was, well, it's C++. We know C++. Right, that's it. That's C++. It's a standard language. Yep. You know, the first C++ did not have move semantics. You know, everything, it was. Anyway, but from C++ 11, we moved over to this three-year model. So everything's changing every 3 years. And that's meant that it's become, you know, the feedback loop is great. We can improve the language really quickly, really effectively, with you know, and find out what it's, yeah, anyway. So yes, the three year cycle is a great cycle.
Okay, I take it you're quite happy with the process, right? How committee works, and or do you have?
Well, so that's an interesting question. I mean, things I don't like. There's a lot of travel. So we meet internationally. So let me see what's happening this year. So the first meeting is in Tokyo. That's in March. The second meeting is in St. Louis, Missouri. That's in the summer. Then this winter we're in Wroclaw, in Europe. Yeah. So we're going continent by continent. Wroclaw, sorry. Yes. We're going continent by continent around the world. The last meeting was in Hawaii, and that's a lot of air miles. That's a lot of flying around. The reason for this, though, is that we can't just have ISO meeting in Geneva all the time, because that, you know, that would it would exclude people who can't get to Switzerland. You know, we have to make sure everyone has, you know, there's a principle of universality. Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with the Red Cross, but in the Red Cross, you know, you have the principle of universality. You know, treat everyone. You know, it doesn't matter if they're a terrorist, whatever, you know, treat everyone.
Yeah.
And in the same way with ISO, principle of universality, everybody can contribute, everybody can participate. You know, if someone comes from a place with really dicey ethical considerations, that's actually not a barrier to contribute. You can't sit in judgment. You're not allowed to sit in judgment. You can't say, oh, no, only Westerners who adhere to my moral code. They're allowed to participate in WU20. No, that's not going to fly.
Yeah.
You know, that can in itself cause its own problems. Meeting around the world is problematic. You can attend remotely. So I am actually going to fly to Tokyo because the time difference is like 9 or 10 hours. It's a big time difference. I would effectively have to spend the weekend before wrenching my body clock nocturnally. And then the weekend afterwards, wrenching it back again, which would be, you know, problematic. And to be honest, one of the important parts of the meeting is the networking that goes on, is cooking up the new ideas and, you know, checking how things are going. Because the actual sessions where you're discussing papers are fine. You know, they're very effective. But quite often you need the more informal conversations, the hallway track it's called. But you need the more informal conversations to push kind of the meta discussions forward of how things are of how things are moving. So that kind of has to happen. There are people who do dial in remotely from, you know, reasonably proximate time zones. Certainly when we're in Europe, you know, it's 8 o'clock in the morning on the West Coast when it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon here. So you know, and in, you know, New York is 5 hours behind. So they can get a lot of, you know, they can get a lot, you know, when we were in Belfast, for example, there would have been opportunity to die for kind of a broad stretch. But Tokyo, it's, you know, it's right out of the way. You're either there or you're...
How many people attend these meetings?
Well, let's see. So when C++ 20, when we shipped C++ 20, that was in Prague, there was something like 250 people.
Okay.
Now, that was before the pandemic. During the pandemic, we... got a system of of remote participation. We nailed it down, did really well, and this was actually quite positive because it meant that NUG, the Library Evolution Working Group, we could meet every week rather than 3 times a year, and we could like look at one paper a week, think about it, go, oh yeah, right, okay, and that proved to be very effective. Last meeting I attended in person was in Varna on the Black Sea coast. Actually, it was in Golden Sands, which is a little bit northeast of Varna. And that had, I think, it was a little over 100 people, but a lot of people dialing in as well. It's problematic going to something like going to a beach resort for a community. Yeah. You know, because a lot of people see I my company doesn't send me, my employers don't send me to these things.
Yeah.
I have to go, well, but for people whose employers send them these courses, oh yeah, I need to go to the next CFLOS committee. It's in the Golden Sands Beach Resort on the Black Sea. Yeah. Is it really? Well, no, you're not. Obviously, you know, you can't go on this job. It's in Kona in Hawaii. No, it becomes a problematic thing for bosses to send people. So, you know, that can be tricky. We are constrained, though. You know, hosting is expensive. ISO doesn't pay for us to meet. We have to find a sponsor who will say, yep, yeah, sure, I will pay for this to happen. You know, you're looking at $30,000 for a meeting because you've got to hire conference rooms, you know, for a week. You've got to get projectors. There's you know, it is not a cheap undertaking.
How do you sponsor these then?
You write to Herb and say, hey, Herb. So Herb Sutter is the convener of WG21, and he says his remit includes choosing where to meet. And so you write to Herb and you say, hey, Herb, I'd like to host the next WG21 meeting. He'll say, sure, absolutely. Where would you like to host it? And you say, oh, I'd like to host it in Stockholm, please, because my company's in Stockholm and I get lots. The advertising is spectacular, obviously, because you know, you are being associated with being at the very top of the tree. You know, you are serious engineers who take programming very seriously when you're sponsoring this sort of thing. In Prague, Avast sponsored, and you know, it really elevated their profile. It's a good thing to do. You just write to her because we're always on the lookout for places to meet, particularly if they're not in holiday resorts. That's that's also good.
So one thing that you would improve in the process of adding new features in C++, what do you think?
Wow. One thing I would improve, let's see. Do you know, I'm almost institutionalized now. It just seems perfect in every way. because I've become so habituated to it. I think I would slow things down a bit.
Slow? Okay.
Yeah, I think we're in the, you know, we can just wave things through quite quickly. And I think there needs to be a higher bar. You know, the standard is growing rapidly and there's great stuff going in there, but I do wonder if there needs to be a higher bar to getting things in. You know, I've been working on this linear algebra proposal for a while now, and you know, it's in my spare time. And it's not finished. And I was hoping I'd get it in for C++ 26, but the thing is, to do that, I'd need to complete the design and you know, socialize it around the world, not just around the committee, such that everyone can look at it and go, yeah, this is fine. And so I can go to Library Lucian Working Group, right, this GitHub library has got 1,000 stars. Can we add it in? You know, that's a big undertaking. I'm going to try, but...
your proposal, your algebra proposal, is this the one that you can look it up if you say hardcut GitHub matrix Git, something like this?
No, because it's hosted by a chap called Bob Stiegel. What you want to do, you go to wg21.link/p1385. I'm sure you can remember that. if you want to look at any paper, any proposal, the place to go to is wg21.link. Okay. Okay, so Mara Boss, I believe, put the basically created this system for us where you go to wg21.link and it comes up with a page of instructions on how to use it, and you can access any issue that's currently in flight in GitHub, any proposal. So wg21.link, then a slash, and then the proposal number that you want to look at. So you have to know what the proposal is you're looking for.
Okay.
Mine is P1385. We haven't had a revision for a while because we're just both busy people, and then there was the pandemic and things like that, and it's been battered back and forth around the committee about what it should look like everywhere. But when I get a goddamn moment, I'm going to try and finish this piece.
Okay, I think we covered the committee very well. Then I'd like to turn into more technical again. because we switched, I think, back. Can you tell me a little bit more about memory in games, and how do you handle memory in general, like quite from the technical perspective? Like, let me do a bit of introduction, because I'm coming from software engineer point of view, and most of our languages, with like high level languages, not C++, but even higher, like TypeScript, Python, Java, they all garbage collected. Like, we are long past the point where we care about memory. Like, for us, it's infinite, right? Just like we have like a cluster. If it doesn't fit in one container, we add more containers. It's everything pretty much gum, right?
Nothing, like, people.
Yeah. It's just like, whatever. And if somebody wants to really take, let's say, deep dive, they will find out that there is a stack and heap, and that's it, like, pretty much. And garbage collector does everything, pretty much. That's the you know, like 95% of it. And when I'm looking into things that are more low level, I kind of realize that stack and heap is kind of also like an abstraction, right? Like, on the OS level, there is no heap per se. It's just memory. You can allocate it and deallocate it, right? So when you're doing low level games programming, how do you handle memory? How do you think about memory? Like, how do you conceptualize it?
Okay. Oh, great question. So I've got a 2-hour talk on this. I'll try and trim this down. The preeminent feature of C++, the one feature of C++ that makes this language stand out from any other is deterministic destruction. You know that when the name of an object falls out of scope, then the thing that it's attached to gets destroyed and all its resources are released, including the memory that it's occupying, or rather the address space that it's occupying. Now, for that to be the case, that means you need to manage the memory very closely. And there are four classes of storage. Okay, so there's static storage, automatic storage, thread local storage, and then there's dynamic storage. So automatic storage is what happens on the heap. So you open a function, so you go into a function, you open a pair of curly braces, you declare a name and define an object, and when that name falls out of scope, the object that it's bound to is destroyed. So that's really simple. We don't need to think about that at all. Then we have static storage. Now, this is these objects are initialized at startup. So you start your program, you run all your static storage, you initialize all your static objects, and then you call main. This comes with its own set of problems, because you might have there might be circular dependencies going on that you can't resolve because you haven't hit main yet. And then you've got thread local storage, and this is like static storage, but it's per thread. So when a thread is spun up, then it will do all its thread local static storage. So the tricky one is when you want an object whose life cycle is neither that of a function nor that of the entirety of the program. Yeah. You know, so it kind of works, in between. You want something to persist for a while, but not for the entirety of the program. But you want it to persist longer than the function which you created. And that's when you have to use dynamic allocation. So static, dynamic, automatic, thread local. Those are your four storage classes. Now, dynamic allocation, unfortunately, because it's not automatic, because it's something that you schedule, means that you have to look after when things are created and when they're destroyed. You also have to look after how they're created and destroyed. Well, you don't have to look after that, but if you don't, it's going to cost you. Because by default, when you say, all right, I just want to allocate this thing on the heap, and then the heap goes, okay, great, how many bytes do you want? And you say, I want 64. They go, there you are, there's 64 bytes. The thing is, allocating and deallocating, allocating and freeing, can really fragment your address space. It can make lots of, you might have like dozens and dozens of tiny, tiny little allocations, and then a few, and you get this thing called fragmentation, where you'll allocate a lot of things, but you'll deallocate a few of them, and you might have only used half of your address space, but it's completely swamped by these little pockmarks, these little holes in your address space, where you can't make larger allocations. So what you have to, there needs to be this whole set of strategies for ensuring that you minimize the amount of fragmentation. And usually you'll do these things called slab allocators or arena allocators. And that's where you'll say, right, I want you to put all the 64 byte allocations in here, or I want to put all the 512K allocations in here. And the advantage of that is that you don't get unwanted holes, because any hole will be immediately filled by another 64 or 512K allocation. The other thing that you might know about that heap allocation won't know about is how long you're going to be allocating something for. Now, if you know that you're only going to be allocating a thing for a particular, you know, one tick in the game, for example, or for, you know, it's going to be allocated, it's going to be deallocated by the time this frame, this function is exited, then, you know, you can say, all right, well, look, all of these things that we know are going to be destroyed by the time this frame exits, we can create a little bit of memory for there, a small subheap for that, because we know it's going to be a small number, and we know it's going to be empty by the time we get out of this frame, and then we can start, and then we can start again. So those sorts of things will, you know, will improve the you know, improve the performance of your memory allocation. The trouble with your default allocation is the worst case scenario. You're saying, that allocator says, I don't know how big these things are going to be, I don't know how long you're going to want them, so, you know, here you are. Now, this was much more of a problem in the sort of 32-bit days, because in the 32-bit days, when I was writing a game on Windows, I had 2 gigabytes of address space, or 3 gigabytes if I could persuade the user to muck about a bit. But, you know, with 2 gigabytes of address space, you know, modern games, you run out of that quite quickly. You find yourself trying to, you know, shoehorn things in the right place to, you know, trying to just to administrate all of this memory. It's an enormous problem, because the other thing that you've got to do besides administrate all this is keep track of it all. You've got to know when you're filling up your amount of space, and when, you know, what your largest available allocation is. You know, you've got to know these things so that you can control what's going on. You can't control what you can't measure. So writing all those feedback systems that say, hey, you know, you've got a lot of allocations of 64 bytes going on here, maybe they could have their own arena or something like that. These are all things that you need to take into account. It's a big topic, you know, it really is a big topic. And I think that it doesn't seem to be something that's taught in universities or anything like that. You know, I go to a lot of universities and say, hello, my name's Guy, come and write games. And I usually give a lecture, and I give a lecture about, you know, low-level stuff like memory management. And it's a closed book to everyone, but it's absolutely critical. You've got to manage your memory. You've got to manage your resources. Otherwise, your game will fall to the ground. It will crash and burn. There are plenty of titles out there that have suffered enormously from, you know, not being able to manage their memory appropriately.
Do you think that games, why in the other parts of software engineering we don't do that so meticulously?
You don't need to. So, look, I've got a PlayStation 5, okay? Actually, let's go back a bit. I've got a PlayStation 2. I've got 32 megabytes of RAM. I can't add more RAM. I can't do any of that. That option is not open to me. When you're working on a domestically specified device, that's what you have. Embedded programming, same sort of situation. You know, in embedded programming, you have a few K, and that's it. You can't say,
But today, now, all of our machines, both on the, let's say, gaming PCs, have more memory, as well as servers that, let's say, run web servers or whatever. Why is that? Why is that our gaming PCs with 64 gigabytes of RAM? Let me ask another question.
Yeah.
What is the default memory that you're thinking about now when you're making a big PC game? If it's 64, then you pretty much have probably a lot of space to not care about the memory.
Well, unfortunately, no.
Okay.
This is the big problem. The thing is, you see, you've got 64 gigabytes of RAM in your machine, but you have a whole bunch of processes running. They're all taking up a bit of memory address, of address space. The thing is, I keep saying address space and not memory, because address space is each process that's running has its own address space. And if all your processes had the full amount of address space available to them as 64-bit processes, then they would quickly completely exhaust the RAM in your machine, because a 64-bit address space is exabytes in size, you know, and you've only got gigabytes of RAM in your machine. What happens is that you use up some of your address space. All of these processes, they'll use up some of their address space, and that portion of the address space that's in use is what is backed in RAM. Okay, now the more RAM you put in, the more processes you can run, the more address space they'll take up. But the thing is, sooner or later, you're going to run out of RAM. You'll have so many processes doing so many things that you'll run out of RAM. Even if you're running a game, you might end up, your process might grow and grow and grow, and then your address space will fill up. Well, no, your address space won't fill up, but your RAM will your address space will exceed the amount of RAM available for backing. Now, what happens then is it'll swap it out to disk. It'll say, all right, yeah, you want this page, you can swap out to disk. You don't want that happening. That slows your game down. You know, a swap takes time. You know, it is a non-trivial amount of time. It is a measurable, observable amount of time when a swap happens. So you want to keep your address space utilization optimal. You want to keep it as unfragmented as possible so that you don't end up swapping. Because you say you've got a 64 gigabyte machine. There are people still playing Total War on laptops with 4 gigabytes of RAM. You know,
okay.
You can't just say, hey, all our games, they've got 64 gig, that's fine. If they haven't got 64 gig, honestly, get a life, you loser. You can't say that. You minimize your addressable market. You know, okay. 64 gig is a lot of RAM. But
you have to have a conception of the, let's say, minimum memory that you're...
Yeah. I don't know what the min spec for the last Total War game was. I think it was 8 gig. I think we're going to be at 8 gig for a while. It's, you know, you've got the Steam survey. We'll tell you what people have.
Yeah.
You know, it's... You can decide, all right, I'm going to insist on 32 gig of RAM, but that's going to cost you customers. You know, customers say, oh, I don't have 32 gig of RAM, I can't play this game. I had a machine. So I bought a new machine in November. I bought a machine at the end of last year, and it's my first new machine since 2011.
Okay.
Now, I've upgraded the graphics card, but the motherboard and processor is still the motherboard and processor I was using in 2011. And I was able to run games fine. You know, all the games I wanted to play, I was able to play, which that's worth bearing in mind. You know, 12 years, you know, no one's releasing games for the PlayStation 3 anymore. And that was prevalent in 2011. Anyway, so 12 years, I got an upgrade. Now, one of the games, and one of the things that drove this was that I wanted to play Deathloop. I don't know if you've come across Deathloop.
Yeah.
Fantastic game. Really, really interesting, clever game. I've enjoyed it very much. I really have. And Arkane Leon are to be congratulated on, you know, really good production there. I tried playing it on my 12-year-old machine. Wouldn't have it. It just fell over. And it kept on crashing and giving me dialog boxes saying, oh, exception here. And I sent my specs to... I contacted technical support at Arkane, and they said, oh, well, yeah, your machine's not up to the job. And there was this... And it was the first time that I'd had a game that I couldn't play for which the machine wasn't up to the job. And so I thought, all right, well, I'm going to have to upgrade, aren't I? And so I did upgrade, and I went all in. So I thought, well, I've got a new job coming up. I'm going to be fully remote. I may as well absolutely go for it. So I've got 64 gigabytes of RAM. I've got a 3090 NVIDIA GPU part because I couldn't be bothered with the 40 series. I've got monitors up the wazoo. You know, I absolutely went for it. And it's a great, you know, I've got a great piece of kit. But it cost me, you know, over $2,000.
Yeah.
A console doesn't cost you $2,000. A console costs you, you know, a few hundred pounds. And you know, if you're going to buy a PC for a few hundred pounds to play games on, you know, it's all very well developers having massively specified machines at their desks, but those aren't the machines that their customers will be running on. That's why you have to worry about memory. You have to worry about optimizing your resource utilization at all times.
Yeah. So can you let's say throw in some of the examples? You mentioned the linear allocators to have not to fragment your memory, but to allocate some chunks of memory of the same size alongside mm-hmm. each other. What are the other techniques for the memory
optimization? Okay, so for example, you could have what I call a stack allocator. So this is an allocator that works like a stack in that you allocate and deallocate in reverse order. Sorry, you deallocate in reverse order of allocation. So it works like a stack, but you can't be certain that other allocations won't be happening in between. So for example, if you have a user interface screen and you say, right, okay, you're in the front end of a game and you say, right, I want to tweak the graphics, I want to tweak the graphics options, I want to tweak the shader options. So you've got three screens coming up in front of you. Now, whilst you're making changes on those screens, you're obviously creating objects which are going to feed back into how the game is operating, the objects that will describe the game, you behave like this. But the screens themselves, you know that you're going to go back through the screens. They're going to be created in order of navigation through the screens and destroyed in reverse order. So you can say, all right, well, look, let's allocate everything and then deallocate everything in reverse order. And let's have a special area just for the UI components.
Okay.
So that means that you don't get fragmentation, because otherwise you'd be allocating those things and then you get your little objects that you're allocating for much longer, and then you lose all your user interface components, okay. Allocations, and you've got these little bits scattered around that you're creating in the way. This is the typical problem that you get with allocations. You allocate objects in order to allocate other objects, and then you deallocate loads of the objects that you created, but the one that was meant to last a long time ends up sort of stuck in the middle of nowhere.
Okay. So we're trying to match the life cycle of the objects to the allocation and have it closely connected to allocate and deallocate at the same time, the proper, let's say, life cycles. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How about disk IO? How do you handle? I know it's a big.
Yeah, you're really knocking them out here, aren't you? So yeah, disk IO. IO in general is a big deal. So,
you know, it's like if you're dealing with C++, for example, like if you're doing this like a hobby project, games, things like that, I don't really run into a lot of problems with IO. Like maybe it's because of I'm using tools that already have some solutions for this, but if I manage my memory, like maybe that's because of the scope of the project, but if at some point, probably in larger games, you run into issues with disk IO and you need to handle it differently. So what happens in the larger scope?
So let's talk about loading screens. You know, because that's really what we're getting at here, loading screens. So the reason that we have loading screens is because we can't keep everything in RAM at the same time. We can't keep everything in the address space. We have to evict some things and put other things in there instead. Now, and what we really mean by that is we can't keep things in RAM all the time. We have to keep them somewhere else. And so if we can't keep it in RAM, the next best thing is offline storage. So this is stuff that's not connected to the motherboard, so stuff that's not soldered to the motherboard, but is connected through wires and pins. You know, RAM is actually electrically connected to your motherboard. You know, there is a direct connection through tracks from RAM to your MMU on your CPU. You know, that's great. That's as fast as it's going to get. So for file IO, you've obviously got this other problem of having to get through the wires. Now you store stuff on storage devices, on SSDs, and you move it into RAM and you move the stuff that's in RAM either back onto the SSD or you just discard it entirely. Now, let's look at what's on offer here. Because at the highest level of abstraction, C++ will offer you streams. There's a streaming library, and you'd create an fstream object and say, all right, here's the file name, and here's the here are the attributes, and please read this file into this buffer here. And the thing is, this is implemented in terms of C's, the C library. So the C library will say, we call fread, fopen, fclose, And that's implemented in terms of the operating system instructions. So on Windows, you'd be saying, well, okay, so like we have create file, read file. And the thing is, as you go further down the abstraction stack, you're getting more and more parameters in your functions. There's more, there are more things to control. Now, the trouble with this is that actually what you want in a game is you want to say, I have a file name, please give me a buffer. That's all you care about. Please give me a buffer that's filled with the contents of this file. I don't care how I get it, but I want it as fast as possible. Please. Yeah. File name, buffer. You know, file name in my left hand, buffer in my right hand. That's what you're saying. Or you're saying, here's a file. Look, I've got a file name and I've got a buffer. Please fill this buffer up with, incidentally, don't bother. You know, don't say, please fill this buffer with the contents of this file. Say, look, here's a file name, give me a buffer. And then you can decide whether or not you want to migrate that buffer to your, because sooner or later, there is going to be that copy. You know, if you give a buffer, if you say, I want this data at this address, you know, a copy will be happening. Anyway, what you want is a library that says, file name, buffer, please. So rather than calling fstream, rather than creating an fstream object, or rather than calling fopen, fread, or rather than calling create file, read file, all that stuff, you can just carry on down the abstraction stack and do that yourself. You know, it's well-defined. File name to buffer, please. You know, it's a well-defined API. So what the Windows operating system does, and I presume all the others do, is it'll map memory. So what you can do is you can say, all right, I've got some files here. One thing that the x86 processor series allows me to do is to map areas of storage, of offline storage, into my address space. You say, right, these sectors are now at address, you know, the sectors on this hard disk drive or the RAM cells on this SSD, these correspond to this address here. And that's great, because what that means, you can say, well, I'll dereference this memory address, and then the operating system will go, hang on a minute, I'll just get that from the SSD for you. But you don't care about that. You don't need to know about that. What you have is an address space with, and it could be RAM or it can be file, you know, offline storage or anything. You, the client, you just said, file name buffer, please. And then you can read the buffer when you're ready to go. And reading the buffer effectively means migrating the thing into RAM. And that's why you don't want to provide a buffer. You just want to use the buffer the OS hands to you. And if you want to copy it to RAM, then fine, you can do that yourself. But that's an extra step that you must choose to undertake, because sometimes you won't need to do that, and you don't want to write an API where you're constantly saying, and then copy it once it's in RAM, copy it to another place in RAM. That, you know, nobody wants that. So that's the 5 minute memory file IO talk. There are all sorts of ways of achieving it, but memory mapping, as far as I've discovered, memory mapping is optimal.
Okay, so it's about, at least what they're saying, it's about skipping the layers of abstraction and going around them and avoiding copying, unnecessary copying things in the memory.
Nice. You could do the whole thing if you wanted. You could do fread. You could do fstream, and read if you liked, but it would be slower. You know, no one likes to be hanging around in a loading screen. You know, the fastest way that you can get a buffer from your file name, you know, that's the way.
Why games don't do loading screens that are more interactive? I'm not sure.
Some are great. Some loading screens, you don't realize it's a loading screen.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. These are, yeah.
Think of open world games where you're just constantly roaming in the game, and it's all just popping into place. There's no loading screen there. That's really, 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 really hard, though. That is really hard, because the workflow that's required to synchronize, to align your designers so they never end up suddenly causing a big spike in loading is not trivial.
Okay. Any low-level game programming tips? What would you say? Like,
wow. Okay. Oh, I guess the best low-level game programming tip is to just do it. Just make sure you know how file IO works, how memory management works. Make sure you know, read up on OSs. Make sure you know how an OS works. Because if you don't, then you're staggering in the dark. I'm still not completely conversant with Windows. You know, it's changing all the time. You know,
that's not a positive vision. If you're not convinced how Windows works, and you've been there whole life, how young people interacting with this world will know?
Start with FileIO. Once you get the hang of FileIO, that does cover a lot of stuff. But like networking, you know, networking's a big deal. You do have to put the hours in. You really, really do. There are no shortcuts to getting this stuff right. You can use somebody else's library, and you can hope that it's working at a sufficiently low level of abstraction for you. But you know, you're relying on that person. You're relying on that library and what they're saying.
Yeah. Where would you go if you want to read up on the source? Would you go try to do this through the like references online from the books published?
It's all books. It's experience. I mean, this is the trouble with experience. It's very hard won because you grow in experience accidentally. You know, you don't realize what it is that you don't know until you know it, and you think, oh, I didn't know that. All right, okay, great. I've learned a thing. You know, the reason why I read a lot. I read a lot. Okay, and to stay on top of things. You know, I guess if you're programming on Windows, you go to the. I'll just find it actually. Just 1 second.
You mean the reference, the documentation?
Documentation, creating and opening files, Win32 apps. Here we are. Yeah, so, this is great. There's local file systems. Yeah, if you go to the Win32 desktop technologies, just browse around the Microsoft Windows app development stuff. You know, because that's what you're doing when you're writing a game for PC, is you're writing a Windows game. You're writing a Windows app that does games. Look at the kernel, you know, read the kernel documentation, all that kind of stuff. You know, read the documentation, because as you're reading the Windows documentation, you learn about how the API works. You learn about all the considerations that it's had to accommodate. You know, you look at the parameter list on create file and you think, okay, those parameters there they're there for a reason. You know, what is the reason? What is the problem that those parameters are trying to abstract? You know, what is it that they're solving?
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. It was lovely.
2 hours? Good Lord.
Yeah.
I'm just getting started.
Time flies by.
Doesn't it?
Thank you so much for chatting. And take care.